THE WERWOLF by Clements Houseman Part One. The great farm hall was ablaze with the firelight and noisy with laughter and talk and many sounding work. None could be idle but the very young and the very old. Little Rol, who was hugging a puppy, and old Trella, whose palsied hand fumbled over her knitting. The early evening had closed in, and the farm servants, come from their outdoor work, had assembled in the ample hall, which gave space for a score or more of workers. Several of the men were engaged in carving, and to these were yielded the best place and light. Others made or repaired fishing tackle and harness, and a great seine net occupied three pairs of hands. Of the women, most were sorting and mixing eider feather and chopping straw to add to it. Looms were there, although not in present use, but three wheels whirred emulously, and the finest and swiftest thread of the three ran between the fingers of the housemistress. Near her were some children, busy too, plaiting wicks for candles and lamps. Each group of workers had a lamp in its center, and those farthest from the fire had live heat from the two braziers filled with glowing wood embers, replenished now and again from the generous hearth. But the flicker of the great fire was manifest to remotest corners and prevailed beyond the limits of the weaker lights. Little Rol grew tired of his puppy, dropped it incontinently, and made an onslaught on Tyre, the old wolfhound, who basked dozing, whimpering, and twitching in his hunting dreams. Prone went Rol beside Tyre, his young arms round the shaggy neck, his curls against the black jowl. Tyre gave a perfunctory lick and stretched with a sleepy sigh. Rol growled and rolled and shoved invitingly, but could only gain from the old dog placid toleration and a half-observant blink. "Take that, then," said Rol, indignant at this ignoring of his advances, and sent the puppy sprawling against the dignity that disdained him as playmate. The dog took no notice, and the child wandered off to find amusement elsewhere. The baskets of white eider feathers caught his eye far off in a distant corner. He slipped under the table and crept along on all fours, the ordinary commonplace custom of walking down a room, upright not being to his fancy. When close to the women, he lay still for a moment, watching, with his elbows on the floor and his chin in his palms. One of the women, seeing him, nodded and smiled, and presently he crept out behind her skirts and passed, hardly noticed, from one to another, till he found opportunity to possess himself of a large handful of feathers. With these he traversed the length of the room, under the table again, and emerged near the spinners. At the feet of the youngest he curled himself round, sheltered by her knees from the observation of the others, and disarmed her of interference by secretly displaying his handful with a confiding smile. A dubious nod satisfied him, and presently he started on the play he had devised. He took a tuft of the white down and gently shook it free of his fingers, close to the whirl of the wheel. The wind of the swift motion took it, spun it round and round in widening circles, till it floated above like a slow white moth. Little Roll's eyes danced, and the row of his small teeth shone in a silent laugh of delight. Another and another of the white tufts was sent whirling round like a winged thing in a spider's web, and floating clear at last. Presently the handful failed. Rol sprawled forward to survey the room and contemplate another journey under the table. His shoulder, thrusting forward, checked the wheel for an instant. He shifted hastily. The wheel flew on with a jerk, and the thread snapped. "Naughty Rol," said the girl. The swiftest wheel stopped also, and the housemistress, Rol's aunt, leaned forward and, sighting the low curly head, gave a warning against mischief and sent him off to old Trella's corner. Rawl obeyed, and after a discreet period of obedience sidled out again down the length of the room farthest from his aunt's eye. As he slipped in among the men, they looked up to see that their tools might be, as far as possible, out of reach of Rawl's hands and close to their own. Nevertheless, before long he managed to secure a fine chisel and take off its point on the leg of the table. The carver's strong objections to this disconcerted Rawl, who for 5 minutes thereafter effaced himself under the table. During this seclusion he contemplated the many pairs of legs that surrounded him and almost shut out the light of the fire. How very odd some of the legs were! Some were curved where they should be straight, and some were straight where they should be curved, and, as Rawl said to himself, they all seemed screwed on differently. Some were tucked away modestly under the benches, others were thrust far out under the table, encroaching on Rawl's own particular domain. He stretched out his own short legs and regarded them critically, and after comparison, favorably. Why were not all legs made like his? Or like his? These legs, approved by Rawl, were a little apart from the rest. He crawled opposite and again made comparison. His face grew quite solemn as he thought of the innumerable days to come before his legs could be as long and strong. He hoped they would be just like those, his models, as straight as to bone and as curved as to muscle. A few moments later, Swain, of the long legs, felt a small hand caressing his foot, and looking down, met the upturned eyes of his little cousin Rawl. Lying on his back, still softly patting and stroking the young man's foot, the child was quiet and happy for a good while. He watched the movement of the strong, deft hands and the shifting of the bright tools. Now and then, minute chips of wood, puffed off by Swain, fell down upon his face. At last he raised himself, very gently, lest a jog should wake impatience in the carver, and, crossing his own legs round Swain's ankle, clasping with his arms too, laid his head against the knee. Such act is evidence of a child's most wonderful hero worship. Quite content was Rawl, and more than content, when Swain paused a minute to joke and pat his head and pull his curls. Quiet he remained as long as quiescence is possible to limbs young as his. Swain forgot he was near, hardly noticed when his leg was gently released, and never saw the stealthy abstraction of one of his tools. 10 minutes thereafter was a lamentable wail from low on the floor, rising to the full pitch of Rawl's healthy lungs, for his hand was gashed across, and the copious bleeding terrified him. Then was there soothing and comforting, washing and binding, and a modicum of scolding, till the loud outcry sank into occasional sobs, and the child, tear-stained and subdued, was returned to the chimney-quarter settle, where Trella nodded. In the reaction after pain and fright, Rawl found that the quiet of that firelit corner was to his mind. Tire, too, disdained him no longer, but roused by his sobs, showed all the concern and sympathy that a dog can by licking and wistful watching. A little shame weighed also upon his spirits. He wished he had not cried quite so much. He remembered how once Swain had come home with his arm torn down from the shoulder and a dead bear, and how he had never winced nor said a word, though his lips turned white with pain. Poor little Rawl gave another sighing sob over his own faint-hearted shortcomings. The light and motion of the great fire began to tell strange stories to the child, and the wind in the chimney roared a corroborative note now and then. the great black mouth of the chimney, impending high over the hearth, received as into a mysterious gulf murky coils of smoke and brightness of aspiring sparks, and beyond, in the high darkness, were muttering and wailing and strange doings, so that sometimes the smoke rushed back in panic and curled out and up to the roof, and condensed itself to invisibility among the rafters. And then the wind would rage after its lost prey, and rush round the house, rattling and shrieking at window and door. In a lull, after one such loud gust, Roll lifted his head in surprise and listened. A lull had also come on the babble of talk, and thus could be heard with strange distinctness a sound outside the door, the sound of a child's voice, a child's hands. "Open, open, let me in," piped the little voice from low down, lower than the handle, and the latch rattled as though a tiptoe child reached up to it, and soft small knocks were struck. One near the door sprang up and opened it. "No one is here," he said. Tyre lifted his head and gave utterance to a howl, loud, prolonged, most dismal. Swain, not able to believe that his ears had deceived him, got up and went to the door. It was a dark night. The clouds were heavy with snow that had fallen fitfully when the wind lulled. Untrodden snow lay up to the porch. There was no sight nor sound of any human being. Swain strained his eyes far and near, only to see dark sky, pure snow, and a line of black fir trees on a hill brow, bowing down before the wind. "Oh, it must have been the wind," he said, and closed the door. Many faces looked scared. The sound of a child's voice had been so distinct, and the words, "Open, open, let me in." The wind might creak the wood or rattle the latch, but could not speak with a child's voice, nor knock with the soft, plain blows that a plump fist gives. And the strange, unusual howl of the wolfhound was an omen to be feared, be the rest what it might. Strange things were said by one and another, till the rebuke of the housemistress quelled them into far-off whispers. For a time after, there was uneasiness, constraint, and silence. Then the chill fear thawed by degrees, and the babble of talk flowed on again. Yet half an hour later, a very slight noise outside the door sufficed to arrest every hand, every tongue. Every head was raised, and every eye fixed in one direction. "It is Christian. He is late," said Swain. "No, no, this is a feeble shuffle, not a young man's tread." With the sound of uncertain feet came the hard tap-tap of a stick against the door, and the high-pitched voice of Eld, "Open, open, let me in." Again Tyre flung up his head in a long, doleful howl. Before the echo of the tapping stick and the high voice had fairly died away, Swain had sprung across to the door and flung it wide. "No one again," he said in a steady voice, though his eyes looked startled as he stared out. He saw the lonely expanse of snow, the clouds swagging low, and between the two the line of dark fir trees bowing in the wind. He closed the door without a word of comment and recrossed the room. A score of blanched faces were turned to him as though he must be solver of the enigma. He could not be unconscious of this mute eye-questioning, and it disturbed his resolute air of composure. He hesitated, glanced toward his mother, the housemistress, then back at the frightened folk, and gravely, before them all, made the sign of the cross. There was a flutter of hands as the sign was repeated by all, and the dead silence was stirred as by a huge sigh, for the held breath of many was freed as though the sign gave magic relief. Even the housemistress was perturbed. She left her wheel and crossed the room to her son and spoke with him for a moment in a low tone that none could overhear. but a moment later her voice was high-pitched and loud, so that all might benefit by her rebuke of the heathen chatter of one of the girls. Perhaps she essayed to silence thus her own misgivings and forebodings. No other voice dared speak now with its natural fullness. Low tones made intermittent murmurs, and now and then silence drifted over the whole room. The handling of tools was as noiseless as might be, and suspended on the instant if the door rattled in a gust of wind. After a time, Swain left his work, joined the group nearest the door, and loitered there on the pretense of giving advice and help to the unskillful. A man's tread was heard outside in the porch. "Christian," said Swain and his mother simultaneously, he confidently, she authoritatively, to set the checked wheels going again. But Tyre flung up his head with an appalling howl. "Open, open, let me in!" It was a man's voice, and the door shook and rattled as a man's strength beat against it. Swain could feel the planks quivering as on the instant his hand was upon the door, flinging it open to face the blank porch, and beyond only snow and sky and firs aslant in the wind. He stood for a long minute with the open door in his hand. The bitter wind swept in with its icy chill, but a deadlier chill of fear came swifter and seemed to freeze the beating of hearts. Swain stepped back to snatch up a great bearskin cloak. "Swain, where are you going?" "No farther than the porch, mother," and he stepped out and closed the door. He wrapped himself in the heavy fur, and, leaning against the most sheltered wall of the porch, steeled his nerves to face the devil and all his works. No sound of voices came from within. The most distinct sound was the crackle and roar of the fire. It was bitterly cold. His feet grew numb, but he forbore stamping them into warmth, lest the sound should strike panic within. Nor would he leave the porch, nor print a footmark on the untrodden white that declared so absolutely how no human voices and hands could have approached the door since snow fell 2 hours or more ago. "When the wind drops, there will be more snow," thought Swain. For the best part of an hour he kept his watch and saw no living thing, heard no unwonted sound. "I will freeze here no longer," he muttered, and re-entered. One woman gave a half-suppressed scream as his hand was laid on the latch, and then a gasp of relief as he came in. No one questioned him, only his mother said, in a tone of forced unconcern, "Could you not see Christian coming?" as though she were made anxious only by the absence of her younger son. Hardly had Swain stamped near to the fire than clear knocking was heard at the door. Tyre leapt from the hearth, his eyes red as the fire, his fangs showing white in the black jowl, his neck ridged and bristling, and overleaping Rawl ramped at the door, barking furiously. Outside the door a clear, mellow voice was calling. Tyre's bark made the words undistinguishable. No one offered to stir towards the door before Swain. He stalked down the room resolutely, lifted the latch, and swung back the door. A white-robed woman glided in. No wraith, living, beautiful, young. Tyre leapt upon her. Lithely she balked the sharp fangs with folds of her long fur robe, and, snatching from her girdle a small two-edged axe, whirled it up for a blow of defense. Swain caught the dog by the collar and dragged him off, yelling and struggling. The stranger stood in the doorway motionless, one foot set forward, one arm flung up, till the housemistress hurried down the room, and Swain, relinquishing to others the furious Tyre, turned again to close the door and offer excuse for so fierce a greeting. Then she lowered her arm, slung the axe in its place at her waist, loosened the furs about her face, and shook over her shoulders the long white robe, all, as it were, with the sway of one movement. She was a maiden, tall and very fair. The fashion of her dress was strange, half masculine, yet not unwomanly. A fine fur tunic, reaching but little below the knee, was all the skirt she wore. Below were the cross-bound shoes and leggings that a hunter wears. A white fur cap was set low upon the brows, and from its edge strips of fur fell lappet-wise about her shoulders. Two of these at her entrance had been drawn forward and crossed about her throat, but now, loosened and thrust back, left unhidden long plaits of fair hair that lay forward on shoulder and breast, down to the ivory-studded girdle where the axe gleamed. Swain and his mother led the stranger to the hearth without question or sign of curiosity, till she voluntarily told her tale of a long journey to distant kindred, a promised guide unmet, and signals and landmarks mistaken. "Alone!" exclaimed Swain in astonishment. "Have you journeyed thus far 100 leagues alone?" She answered, "Yes," with a little smile. "Over the hills and the wastes? Why, the folk there are savage and wild as beasts." She dropped her hand upon her axe with a laugh of some scorn. "I fear neither man nor beast. Some few fear me." And then she told strange tales of fierce attack and defense, and of the bold, free huntress life she had led. Her words came a little slowly and deliberately, as though she spoke in a scarce familiar tongue. Now and then she hesitated and stopped in a phrase, as though for lack of some word. She became the center of a group of listeners. The interest she excited dissipated in some degree the dread inspired by the mysterious voices. There was nothing ominous about this young, bright, fair reality, though her aspect was strange. Little Rol crept near, staring at the stranger with all his might. Unnoticed, he softly stroked and patted a corner of her soft white robe that reached to the floor in ample folds. He laid his cheek against it caressingly, and then edged up close to her knees. "What is your name?" he asked. The stranger's smile and ready answer, as she looked down, saved Rol from the rebuke merited by his unmannerly question. "My real name," she said, "would be uncouth to your ears and tongue. The folk of this country have given me another name, and from this," she laid her hand on the fur robe, "they call me White Fell." Little Rol repeated it to himself, stroking and patting as before. "White Fell, White Fell." The fair face and soft, beautiful dress pleased Rol. He knelt up with his eyes on her face and an air of uncertain determination, like a robin's on a doorstep, and plumped his elbows into her lap with a little gasp at his own audacity. "Rol!" exclaimed his aunt. "But, oh, let him," said White Fell, smiling and stroking his head, and Rol stayed. He advanced farther, and, panting at his own adventurousness in the face of his aunt's authority, climbed up to her knees. Her welcoming arms hindered any protest. He nestled happily, fingering the axe head, the ivory studs in her girdle, the ivory clasp at her throat, the plaits of fair hair. Rubbing his head against the softness of her fur-clad shoulder, with a child's full confidence in the kindness of beauty, White Fell had not uncovered her head, only knotted the pendant fur loosely behind her neck. Rol reached up his hand towards it, whispering her name to himself. "White Fell, White Fell," then slid his arms round her neck and kissed her, once, twice. She laughed delightedly and kissed him again. "The child plagued you?" said Swain. "Oh, no, indeed," she answered, with an earnestness so intense as to seem disproportionate to the occasion. Rol settled himself again on her lap and began to unwind the bandage bound round his hand. He paused a little when he saw where the blood had soaked through, then went on till his hand was bare and the cut displayed, gaping and long, though only skin deep. He held it up towards Whitefell, desirous of her pity and sympathy. At sight of it and the blood-stained linen, she drew in her breath suddenly, clasped Rol to her, hard, hard, till he began to struggle. Her face was hidden behind the boy, so that none could see its expression. It had lighted up with a most awful glee. Afar, beyond the fir grove, beyond the low hill behind, the absent Christian was hastening his return. From daybreak he had been afoot, carrying notice of a bear hunt to all the best hunters of the farms and hamlets that lay within a radius of 12 miles. Nevertheless, having been detained till a late hour, he now broke into a run, going with a long, smooth stride of apparent ease that fast made the miles diminish. He entered the midnight blackness of the fir grove with scarcely slackened pace, though the path was invisible, and passing through into the open again, sighted the farm lying a furlong off down the slope. Then he sprang out freely and almost on the instant gave one great sideways leap and stood still. There in the snow was the track of a great wolf. His hand went to his knife, his only weapon. He stooped, knelt down to bring his eyes to the level of a beast and peered about. His teeth set, his heart beat a little harder than the pace of his running insisted on. A solitary wolf, nearly always savage and of large size, is a formidable beast that will not hesitate to attack a single man. This wolf track was the largest Christian had ever seen, and, so far as he could judge, recently made. It led from under the fir trees down the slope. Well for him, he thought, was the delay that had so vexed him before. Well for him that he had not passed through the dark fir grove when that danger of jaws lurked there. Going warily, he followed the track. It led down the slope, across a broad ice-bound stream, along the level beyond, making towards the farm. A less precise knowledge had doubted and guessed that here might have come straying Big Tyre or his like. But Christian was sure, knowing better than to mistake between footmark of dog and wolf. Straight on, towards the farm. Surprised and anxious grew Christian that a prowling wolf would dare so near. He drew his knife and pressed on, more hastily, more keen-eyed. Oh, that Tyre were with him! Straight on, even to the very door, where the snow failed. His heart seemed to give a great leap and then stop. There the track ended. Nothing lurked in the porch, and there was no sign of return. The firs stood straight against the sky, the clouds lay low, for the wind had fallen, and a few snowflakes came drifting down. In a horror of surprise, Christian stood dazed a moment, then he lifted the latch and went in. His glance took in all the old familiar forms and faces, and with them that of the stranger, fur-clad and beautiful. The awful truth flashed upon him. He knew what she was. Only a few were startled by the rattle of the latch as he entered. The room was filled with bustle and movement, for it was the supper hour, when all tools were laid aside and trestles and tables shifted. Christian had no knowledge of what he said and did. He moved and spoke mechanically, half thinking that soon he must wake from this horrible dream. Swain and his mother supposed him to be cold and dead tired, and spared all unnecessary questions. And he found himself seated beside the hearth, opposite that dreadful thing that looked like a beautiful girl, watching her every movement, curdling with horror to see her fondle the child Rol. Swain stood near them both, intent upon Whitefell also, but how differently! She seemed unconscious of the gaze of both, neither aware of the chill dread in the eyes of Christian, nor of Swain's warm admiration. These two brothers, who were twins, contrasted greatly, despite their striking likeness. They were alike in regular profile, fair brown hair, and deep blue eyes, but Swain's features were perfect as a young god's, while Christian's showed faulty details. Thus, the line of his mouth was set too straight, the eyes shelved too deeply back, and the contour of the face flowed in less generous curves than Swain's. Their height was the same, but Christian was too slender for perfect proportion, while Swain's well-knit frame, broad shoulders, and muscular arms made him preeminent for manly beauty as well as for strength. As a hunter, Swain was without rival, as a fisher, without rival. All the countryside acknowledged him to be the best wrestler, rider, dancer, singer. Only in speed could he be surpassed, and in that only by his younger brother. All others Swain could distance fairly, but Christian could outrun him easily. Aye, he could keep pace with Swain's most breathless burst, and laugh and talk the while. Christian took little pride in this fleetness of foot, counting a man's legs to be the least worthy of his members. He had no envy of his brother's athletic superiority, though to several feats he had made a moderate second. He loved as only a twin can love, proud of all that Swain did, content with all that Swain was, humbly content also that his own great love should not be so exceedingly returned, since he knew himself to be so far less love-worthy. Christian dared not, in the midst of women and children, launch the horror that he knew into words. He waited to consult his brother, but Swain did not, or would not, notice the signal he made, and kept his face always turned towards White Fell. Christian drew away from the hearth, unable to remain passive with that dread upon him. "Where is Tyre?" he said suddenly. Then, catching sight of the dog in a distant corner, "Why is he chained there?" "He flew at the stranger," one answered. Christian's eyes glowed. "Yes?" he said interrogatively. "He was within an ace of having his brain knocked out." "Tyre?" "Yes, she was nimbly up with that little axe she has at her waist. It was well for old Tyre that his master throttled him off." Christian went without a word to the corner where Tyre was chained. The dog rose up to meet him, as piteous and indignant as a dumb beast can be. He stroked the black head. "Good Tyre, brave dog." They knew, they only, and the man and the dumb dog had comfort of each other. Christian's eyes turned again towards Whitefell. Tyre's also, and he strained against the length of the chain. Christian's hand lay on the dog's neck, and he felt it ridge and bristle with a quivering of impotent fury. Then he began to quiver in like manner, with a fury born of reason, not instinct, as impotent morally as was Tyre physically. Oh, the woman's form that he dare not touch! Anything but that! And he, with Tyre, would be free to kill or be killed. Then he turned to ask fresh questions. "How long has the stranger been here?" "Oh, she came about half hour before you." "Who opened the door to her?" "Swain. No one else dared." The tone of the answer was mysterious. "Why?" queried Christian. "Has anything strange happened? Tell me." For answer he was told, in a low undertone, of the summons at the door, thrice repeated, without human agency, and of Tyre's ominous howls, and of Swain's fruitless watch outside. Christian turned towards his brother in a torment of impatience for a word apart. The board was spread, and Swain was leading Whitefell to the guest's place. This was more awful. She would break bread with him under the roof-tree. He started forward and touched Swain's arm, whispered an urgent entreaty. Swain stared and shook his head in angry impatience. Thereupon Christian would take no morsel of food. His opportunity came at last. Whitefell questioned of the landmarks of the country, and of one Cairn Hill, which was an appointed meeting place, at which she was due that night. The housemistress and Swain both exclaimed. "It is 3 long miles away," said Swain, "with no place for shelter but a wretched hut. Stay with us this night, and I will show you the way tomorrow." Whitefell seemed to hesitate. 3 miles, she said. "Then I should be able to see or hear a signal." "I will look out," said Swain. "Then, if there be no signal, you must not leave us." He went to the door. Christian rose silently and followed him out. "Swain, do you know what she is?" Swain, surprised at the vehement grasp and low, hoarse voice, made answer, "She? Who? Whitefell?" "Yes." "She is the most beautiful girl I have ever seen." "She is a werewolf." Swain burst out laughing. "Are you mad?" he asked. "No, here, see for yourself." Christian drew him out of the porch, pointing to the snow where the footmarks had been, for now they were not. Snow was falling fast, and every dent was blotted out. "Well?" asked Swain. "Had you come when I signed to you, you would have seen for yourself." "Seen what?" "The footprints of a wolf leading up to the door. None leading away." It was impossible not to be startled by the tone alone, though it was hardly above a whisper. Swain eyed his brother anxiously, but in the darkness could make nothing of his face. Then he laid his hands kindly and reassuringly on Christian's shoulders and felt how he was quivering with excitement and horror. "One sees strange things," he said, "when the cold has got into the brain behind the eyes. You came in cold and worn out." "No," interrupted Christian. "I saw the track first on the brow of the slope and followed it down right here to the door. This is no delusion." Swain, in his heart, felt positive that it was. Christian was given to daydreams and strange fancies, though never had he been possessed with so mad a notion before. "Don't you believe me?" said Christian desperately. "You must. I swear it is sane truth. Are you blind? Why, even Tyre knows." "You will be clearer headed tomorrow after a night's rest. Then come, too, if you will, with Whitefell to the hill cairn, and if you have doubts still, watch and follow and see what footprints she leaves." Galled by Swain's evident contempt, Christian turned abruptly to the door. Swain caught him back. "What now, Christian? What are you going to do?" "You do not believe me. My mother shall." Swain's grasp tightened. "You shall not tell her," he said authoritatively. Customarily, Christian was so docile to his brother's mastery that it was now a surprising thing when he wrenched himself free vigorously and said as determinedly as Swain, "She shall know." But Swain was nearer the door and would not let him pass. "There has been scare enough for one night already. If this notion of yours will keep, broach it tomorrow." Christian would not yield. "Women are so easily scared," pursued Swain, "and are ready to believe any folly without shadow of proof. Be a man, Christian, and fight this notion of a werewolf by yourself." "If you would believe me," began Christian. "I believe you to be a fool," said Swain, losing patience. "Another, who was not your brother, might believe you to be a knave, and guess that you had transformed Whitefell into a werewolf because she smiled more readily on me than on you." The jest was not without foundation, for the grace of Whitefell's bright looks had been bestowed on him, on Christian never a whit. Swain's coxcombry was always frank and most forgivable, and not without fair color. "If you want an ally," continued Swain, "confide in old Trella. Out of her stores of wisdom, if her memory holds good, she can instruct you in the orthodox manner of tackling a werewolf. If I remember aright, you should watch the suspected person till midnight, when the beast's form must be resumed, and retained ever after if a human eye sees the change. Or, better still, sprinkle hands and feet with holy water, which is certain death. Oh, never fear, but old Trella will be equal to the occasion." Swain's contempt was no longer good-humored. Some touch of irritation or resentment rose at this monstrous doubt of Whitefell. But Christian was too deeply distressed to take offense. "You speak of them as old wives' tales, but if you had seen the proof I have seen, you would be ready at least to wish them true, if not also to put them to the test." "Well," said Swain, with a laugh that had a little sneer in it, "put them to the test. I will not object to that if you will only keep your notions to yourself. Now, Christian, give me your word for silence, and we will freeze here no longer." Christian remained silent. Swain put his hands on his shoulders again and vainly tried to see his face in the darkness. "We have never quarreled yet, Christian." "I have never quarreled," returned the other, aware for the first time that his dictatorial brother had sometimes offered occasion for quarrel had he been ready to take it. "Well," said Swain emphatically, "if you speak against Whitefell to any other, as tonight you have spoken to me, we shall." He delivered the words like an ultimatum, turned sharp round, and re-entered the house. Christian, more fearful and wretched than before, followed. "Snow is falling fast. Not a single light is to be seen." Whitefell's eyes passed over Christian without apparent notice, and turned bright and shining upon Swain. "Nor any signal to be heard?" she queried. "Did you not hear the sound of a sea horn?" "I saw nothing, and heard nothing, and signal or no signal, the heavy snow would keep you here, perforce." She smiled her thanks beautifully, and Christian's heart sank like lead with a deadly foreboding as he noted what a light was kindled in Swain's eyes by her smile. That night, when all others slept, Christian, the weariest of all, watched outside the guest chamber till midnight was past. No sound, not the faintest, could be heard. Could the old tale be true of the midnight change? What was on the other side of the door, a woman or a beast? He would have given his right hand to know. Instinctively, he laid his hand on the latch and drew it softly, though believing that bolts fastened the inner side. The door yielded to his hand. He stood on the threshold. A keen gust of air cut at him. The window stood open. The room was empty. So Christian could sleep with a somewhat lightened heart. In the morning there was surprise and conjecture when Whitefell's absence was discovered. Christian held his peace. Not even to his brother did he say how he knew that she had fled before midnight, and Swain, though evidently greatly chagrined, seemed to disdain reference to the subject of Christian's fears. The elder brother alone joined the bear hunt. Christian found pretext to stay behind. Swain, being out of humor, manifested his contempt by uttering not a single expostulation. All that day, and for many a day after, Christian would never go out of sight of his home. Swain alone noticed how he maneuvered for this, and was clearly annoyed by it. Whitefell's name was never mentioned between them, though not seldom was it heard in general talk. Hardly a day passed, but little Rawl asked when Whitefell would come again. Pretty Whitefell, who kissed like a snowflake. And if Swain answered, Christian would be quite sure that the light in his eyes, kindled by Whitefell's smile, had not yet died out. Little Rawl, naughty, merry, fair-haired little Rawl! A day came when his feet raced over the threshold, never to return, when his chatter and laugh were heard no more, when tears of anguish were wept by eyes that never would see his bright head again, never again, living or dead. He was seen at dusk for the last time escaping from the house with his puppy in freakish rebellion against old Trella. Later, when his absence had begun to cause anxiety, his puppy crept back to the farm, cowed, whimpering, and yelping, a pitiful, dumb lump of terror, without intelligence or courage to guide the frightened search. Rawl was never found, nor any trace of him. Where he had perished was never known. How he had perished was known only by an awful guess. A wild beast had devoured him. Christian heard the conjecture, a wolf, and a horrible certainty flashed upon him that he knew what wolf it was. He tried to declare what he knew, but Swain saw him start at the words with white face and struggling lips, and guessing his purpose, pulled him back and kept him silent, hardly, by his imperious grip and wrathful eyes, and one low whisper. That Christian should retain his most irrational suspicion against beautiful Whitefell was, to Swain, evidence of a weak obstinacy of mind that would but thrive upon expostulation and argument. But this evident intention to direct the passions of grief and anguish to a hatred and fear of the fair stranger, such as his own, was intolerable, and Swain set his will against it. Again Christian yielded to his brother's stronger words and will, and against his own judgment consented to silence. Repentance came before the new moon, the first of the year, was old. Whitefell came again, smiling as she entered, as though assured of a glad and kindly welcome. And in truth there was only one who saw again her fair face and strange white garb without pleasure. Swain's face glowed with delight, while Christian's grew pale and rigid as death. He had given his word to keep silence, but he had not thought that she would dare to come again. Silence was impossible face to face with that thing, impossible. Irrepressibly he cried out, "Where is Rawl?" Not a quiver disturbed Whitefell's face. She heard, yet remained bright and tranquil. Swain's eyes flashed round at his brother dangerously. Among the women some tears fell at the poor child's name, but none caught alarm from its sudden utterance, for the thought of Rawl rose naturally. Where was little Rawl, who had nestled in the stranger's arms, kissing her, and watched for her since, and prattled of her daily? Christian went out silently. One only thing there was that he could do, and he must not delay. His horror overmastered any curiosity to hear Whitefell's smooth excuses and smiling apologies for her strange and uncourteous departure, or her easy tale of the circumstances of her return, or to watch her bearing as she heard the sad tale of little Rawl. The swiftest runner of the countryside had started on his hardest race. Little less than 3 leagues and back, which he reckoned to accomplish in 2 hours, though the night was moonless and the way rugged. He rushed against the still cold air till it felt like a wind upon his face. The dim homestead sank below the ridges at his back, and fresh ridges of snowlands rose out of the obscure horizon level to drive past him as the stirless air drove, and sink away behind into obscure level again. He took no conscious heed of landmarks, not even when all sign of a path was gone under depths of snow. His will was set to reach his goal with unexampled speed, and thither by instinct his physical forces bore him, without one definite thought to guide. And the idle brain lay passive, inert, receiving into its vacancy restless siftings of past sights and sounds, Rawl weeping, laughing, playing, coiled in the arms of that dreadful thing. Tyre, oh, Tyre, white fangs in the black jowl, the women who wept on the foolish puppy, precious for the child's last touch. Footprints from pine wood to door, the smiling face among furs of such womanly beauty, smiling, smiling, and Swain's face. Swain, Swain, oh, Swain, my brother! Swain's angry laugh possessed his ear within the sound of the wind of his speed. Swain's scorn assailed more quick and keen than the biting cold at his throat, and yet he was unimpressed by any thought of how Swain's anger and scorn would rise if this errand were known. The Werewolf by Clements Houseman, Part 2. Swain was a skeptic. His utter disbelief in Christian's testimony regarding the footprints was based upon positive skepticism. His reason refused to bend in accepting the possibility of the supernatural materialized. That a living beast could ever be other than palpably bestial, pawed, toothed, shagged, and eared as such, was to him incredible. Far more, that a human presence could be transformed from its godlike aspect, upright, free-handed, with brows and speech and laughter. The wild and fearful legends that he had known from childhood and then believed, he regarded now as built upon facts distorted, overlaid by imagination, and quickened by superstition. Even the strange summons at the threshold that he himself had vainly answered was, after the first shock of surprise, rationally explained by him as malicious foolery on the part of some clever trickster who withheld the key to the enigma. To the younger brother, all life was a spiritual mystery, veiled from his clear knowledge by the density of flesh. Since he knew his own body to be linked to the complex and antagonistic forces that constitute one soul, it seemed to him not impossibly strange that one spiritual force should possess diverse forms for widely various manifestation. Nor, to him, was it great effort to believe that as pure water washes away all natural foulness, so water, holy by consecration, must needs cleanse God's world from that supernatural evil thing. Therefore, faster than ever man's foot had covered those leagues, he sped under the dark, still night, over the waste, trackless snow ridges, to the faraway church, where salvation lay in the holy water stoop at the door. His faith was as firm as any that wrought miracles in days past, simple as a child's wish, strong as a man's will. He was hardly missed during these hours, every second of which was by him fulfilled to its utmost extent by extremest effort that sinews and nerves could attain. Within the homestead the while, the easy moments went bright with words and looks of unwonted animation, for the kindly, hospitable instincts of the inmates were roused into cordial expression of welcome and interest by the grace and beauty of the returned stranger. But Swain was eager and earnest, with more than a host's courteous warmth. The impression that at her first coming had charmed him, that had lived since through memory, deepened now in her actual presence. Swain, the matchless among men, acknowledged in this fair white fell a spirit high and bold as his own, and a frame so firm and capable that only bulk was lacking for equal strength. Yet the white skin was molded most smoothly, without such muscular swelling as made his might evident. Such love as his frank self-love could conceive was called forth by an ardent admiration for this supreme stranger. More admiration than love was in his passion, and therefore he was free from a lover's hesitancy and delicate reserve and doubts. Frankly and boldly he courted her favor by looks and tones, and an address that came of natural ease, needless of skill, by practice. Nor was she a woman to be wooed otherwise. Tender whispers and sighs would never gain her ear, but her eyes would brighten and shine if she heard of a brave feat, and her prompt hand in sympathy fall swiftly on the axe shaft and clasp it hard. That movement ever fired Swain's admiration anew. He watched for it, strove to elicit it, and glowed when it came. Wonderful and beautiful was that wrist, slender and steel strong. Also the smooth, shapely hand that curved so fast and firm, ready to deal instant death. Desiring to feel the pressure of these hands, this bold lover schemed with palpable directness, proposing that she should hear how their hunting songs were sung with a chorus that signaled hands to be clasped. So his splendid voice gave the verse, and as the chorus was taken up, he claimed her hands, and even through the easy grip felt, as he desired, the strength that was latent, and the vigor that quickened the very fingertips as the song fired her, and her voice was caught out of her by the rhythmic swell, and rang clear on the top of the closing surge. Afterwards she sang alone. For contrast, or in the pride of swaying moods by her voice, she chose a mournful song that drifted along in a minor chant, sad as a wind that dirges. Oh, let me go, around spin wreaths of snow, the dark earth sleeps below. Far up the plain moans on a voice of pain, where shall my babe be lain? In my white breast lay the sweet life to rest, lay where it can lie best. Hush, hush its cries, dense night is on the skies, two stars are in thine eyes. Come, babe, away, but lie thou till dawn be gray, who must be dead by day. This cannot last, but ere the sickening blast all sorrow shall be past, and king shall be low bending at thy knee, worshipping life from thee. For men long sore to hope of what's before, to leave the things of yore. Mine and not thine, how deep their jewels shine, peace laps thy head, not mine. Old Trella came tottering from her corner, shaken to additional palsy by an aroused memory. She strained her dim eyes towards the singer, and then bent her head, that the one ear yet sensible to sound might avail of every note. At the close, groping forward, she murmured with the high-pitched quaver of old age, "So she sang, my Thora, my last and brightest. What is she like, she whose voice is like my dead Thora's? Are her eyes blue?" "Blue as the sky." "So were my Thora's. Is her hair fair and in plaits to the waist?" "Even so," answered Whitefell herself, and met the advancing hands with her own and guided them to corroborate her words by touch. "Like my dead Thora's," repeated the old woman, and then her trembling hands rested on the fur-clad shoulders, and she bent forward and kissed the smooth, fair face that Whitefell upturned, nothing loath, to receive and return the caress. So Christian saw them as he entered. He stood a moment. After the starless darkness and the icy night air and the fierce, silent 2 hours' race, his senses reeled on sudden entrance into warmth and light and the cheery hum of voices. A sudden, unforeseen anguish assailed him as now first he entertained the possibility of being overmatched by her wiles and her daring, if at the approach of pure death she should start up at bay, transformed to a terrible beast, and achieve a savage glut at the last. He looked with horror and pity on the harmless, helpless folk, so unwitting of outrage to their comfort and security. The dreadful thing in their midst, that was veiled from their knowledge by womanly beauty, was a center of pleasant interest. There, before him, signally impressive, was poor old Trella, weakest and feeblest of all, in fond nearness, and a moment might bring about the revelation of a monstrous horror, a ghastly, deadly danger, set loose and at bay in a circle of girls and women and careless, defenseless men. So hideous and terrible a thing as might crack the brain or curdle the heart stone dead. And he alone of the throng prepared. For one breathing space he faltered, no longer than that, while over him swept the agony of compunction that yet could not make him surrender his purpose. He alone? Nay, but Tyre also, and he crossed to the dumb soul sharer of his knowledge. So timeless is thought that a few seconds only lay between his lifting of the latch and his loosening of Tyre's collar, but in those few seconds succeeding his first glance, as lightning swift had been the impulses of others, their motion as quick and sure. Swain's vigilant eye had darted upon him, and instantly his every fiber was alert with hostile instinct. And, half divining, half incredulous of Christian's object in stooping to Tyre, he came hastily, wary, wrathful, resolute to oppose the malice of his wild-eyed brother. But beyond Swain, Rose White fell, blanching white as her furs, and with eyes grown fierce and wild. She leapt down the room to the door, whirling her long robe closely to her. "Hark!" she panted. "The signal horn! Hark! I must go!" as she snatched at the latch to be out and away. For one precious moment Christian had hesitated on the half-loosened collar, for except the womanly form were exchanged for the bestial, Tyre's jaws would gnash to rags his honor of manhood. Then he heard her voice and turned. Too late. As she tugged at the door, he sprang across, grasping his flask, but Swain dashed between and caught him back irresistibly, so that a most frantic effort only availed to wrench one arm free. With that, on the impulse of sheer despair, he cast at her with all his force. The door swung behind her, and the flask flew into fragments against it. Then, as Swain's grasp slackened, and he met the questioning astonishment of surrounding faces with a hoarse, inarticulate cry, "God help us all," he said, "she is a werewolf." Swain turned upon him, "Liar, coward," and his hands gripped his brother's throat with deadly force, as though the spoken word could be killed so. And as Christian struggled, lifted him clear off his feet, and flung him crashing backward. So furious was he that, as his brother lay motionless, he stirred him roughly with his foot till their mother came between, crying shame. And yet then he stood by, his teeth set, his brows knit, his hands clenched, ready to enforce silence again violently, as Christian rose staggering and bewildered. But utter silence and submission were more than he expected, and turned his anger into contempt for one so easily cowed and held in subjection by mere force. "He's mad," he said, turning on his heel as he spoke, so that he lost his mother's look of pained reproach at this sudden free utterance of what was a lurking dread within her. Christian was too spent for the effort of speech. His hard-drawn breath labored in great sobs, his limbs were powerless and unstrung in utter relax after hard service. Failure in his endeavor induced a stupor of misery and despair. In addition was the wretched humiliation of open violence and strife with his brother, and the distress of hearing misjudging contempt expressed without reserve. For he was aware that Swain had turned to allay the scared excitement, half by imperious mastery, half by explanation and argument that showed painful disregard of brotherly consideration. All this unkindness of his twin he charged upon the fell thing who had wrought this their first dissension, and most terrible thought, interposed between them so effectually that Swain was wilfully blind and deaf on her account, resentful of interference, arbitrary, beyond reason. Dread and perplexity unfathomable darkened upon him. Unshared, the burden was overwhelming, a foreboding of unspeakable calamity, based upon his ghastly discovery, bore down upon him, crushing out hope of power to withstand impending fate. Swain, the while, was observant of his brother, despite the continual check of finding, turn and glance when he would, Christian's eyes always upon him, with a strange look of helpless distress, discomposing enough to the angry aggressor. "Like a beaten dog," he said to himself, rallying contempt to withstand compunction. Observation set him wondering on Christian's exhausted condition. The heavy laboring breath and the slack, inert fall of the limbs told surely of unusual and prolonged exertion. And then why had close upon 2 hours' absence been followed by open hostility against Whitefell? Suddenly, the fragments of the flask giving a clue, he guessed all and faced about to stare at his brother in amaze. He forgot that the motive scheme was against Whitefell, demanding derision and resentment from him. That was swept out of remembrance by astonishment and admiration for the feat of speed and endurance. In eagerness to question, he inclined to attempt a generous part and frankly offer to heal the breach. But Christian's depression and sad following gaze provoked him to self-justification by recalling the offense of that outrageous utterance against Whitefell, and the impulse passed. Then other considerations counseled silence, and afterwards a humor possessed him to wait and see how Christian would find opportunity to proclaim his performance and establish the fact without exciting ridicule on account of the absurdity of the errand. This expectation remained unfulfilled. Christian never attempted the proud avowal that would have placed his feat on record to be told to the next generation. That night, Swain and his mother talked long and late together, shaping into certainty the suspicion that Christian's mind had lost its balance, and discussing the evident cause. For Swain, declaring his own love for Whitefell, suggested that his unfortunate brother, with a like passion, they being twins in loves as in birth, had, through jealousy and despair, turned from love to hate, until reason failed at the strain and a craze developed, which the malice and treachery of madness made a serious and dangerous force. So Swain theorized, convincing himself as he spoke, convincing afterwards others who advanced doubts against Whitefell, fettering his judgment by his advocacy, and by his staunch defense of her hurried flight, silencing his own inner consciousness of the unaccountability of her action. But a little time, and Swain lost his vantage in the shock of a fresh horror at the homestead. Trella was no more, and her end a mystery. The poor old woman crawled out in a bright gleam to visit a bedridden gossip living beyond the fir grove. Under the tree she was last seen, halting for her companion, sent back for a forgotten present. Quick alarm sprang, calling every man to the search. Her stick was found among the brushwood only a few paces from the path, but no track or stain, for a gusty wind was sifting the snow from the branches and hid all sign of how she came by her death. So panic-stricken were the farm folk that none dared go singly on the search. Known danger could be braced, but not this stealthy death that walked by day invisible, that cut off alike the child in his play and the aged woman so near to her quiet grave. "Roll, she kissed! Trella, she kissed!" So rang Christian's frantic cry, again and again, till Swain dragged him away and strove to keep him apart, albeit in his agony of grief and remorse he accused himself wildly as answerable for the tragedy, and gave clear proof that the charge of madness was well founded, if strange looks and desperate incoherent words were evidence enough. But thenceforward all Swain's reasoning and mastery could not uphold White Fell above suspicion. He was not called upon to defend her from accusation when Christian had been brought to silence again, but he well knew the significance of this fact, that her name, formerly uttered freely and often, he never heard now. It was huddled away into whispers that he could not catch. The passing of time did not sweep away the superstitious fears that Swain despised. He was angry and anxious, eager that Whitefell should return, and merely by her bright, gracious presence reinstate herself in favor. But doubtful if all his authority and example could keep from her notice an altered aspect of welcome, and he foresaw clearly that Christian would prove unmanageable and might be capable of some dangerous outbreak. For a time the twins' variance was marked, on Swain's part by an air of rigid indifference, on Christian's by heavy downcast silence and a nervous, apprehensive observation of his brother. Superadded to his remorse and foreboding, Swain's displeasure weighed upon him intolerably, and the remembrance of their violent rupture was a ceaseless misery. The elder brother, self-sufficient and insensitive, could little know how deeply his unkindness stabbed. A depth and force of affection such as Christian's was unknown to him. The loyal subservience that he could not appreciate had encouraged him to domineer. This strenuous opposition to his reason and will was accounted as furious malice, if not sheer insanity. Christian's surveillance galled him incessantly, and embarrassment and danger he foresaw as the outcome. Therefore, that suspicion might be lulled, he judged it wise to make overtures for peace. Most easily done. A little kindliness, a few evidences of consideration, a slight return of the old brotherly imperiousness, and Christian replied by a gratefulness and relief that might have touched him had he understood all, but instead increased his secret contempt. So successful was this finesse that when, late on a day, a message summoning Christian to a distance was transmitted by Swain, no doubt of its genuineness occurred. When his errand proved useless, he set out to return. Mistake or misapprehension was all that he surmised. Not till he sighted the homestead lying low between the night-gray snow ridges did vivid recollection of the time when he had tracked that horror to the door rouse an intense dread, and with it a hardly defined suspicion. His grasp tightened on the bear spear that he carried as a staff. Every sense was alert, every muscle strung. Excitement urged him on, caution checked him, and the two governed his long stride, swiftly, noiselessly, to the climax he felt was at hand. As he drew near to the outer gates, a light shadow stirred and went, as though the gray of the snow had taken detached motion. A darker shadow stayed and faced Christian, striking his life-blood chill with utmost despair. Swain stood before him, and surely the shadow that went was Whitefell. They had been together, close. Had she not been in his arms, near enough for lips to meet? There was no moon, but the stars gave light enough to show that Swain's face was flushed and elate. The flush remained, though the expression changed quickly at sight of his brother. How, if Christian had seen all, should one of his frenzied outbursts be met and managed? By resolution? By indifference? He halted between the two, and as a result he swaggered. "Whitefell?" questioned Christian, hoarse and breathless. "Yes?" Swain's answer was a query, with an intonation that implied he was clearing the ground for action. From Christian came, "Have you kissed her?" like a bolt direct, staggering Swain by its sheer prompt temerity. He flushed yet darker, and yet half smiled over this earnest of success he had won. Had there been really between himself and Christian the rivalry that he imagined, his face had enough of the insolence of triumph to exasperate jealous rage. "You dare ask this?" "Swain, oh, Swain, I must know. You have." The ring of despair and anguish in his tone angered Swain, misconstruing it. Jealousy urging to such presumption was intolerable. "Mad fool," he said, constraining himself no longer. "Win for yourself a woman to kiss. Leave mine without question. Such an one as I should desire to kiss is such an one as shall never allow a kiss to you." Then Christian fully understood his supposition. I, he cried. "Whitefell, that deadly thing? Swain, are you blind, mad? I would save you from her, a werewolf." Swain, maddened again at the accusation, a dastardly way of revenge, as he conceived, and instantly, for the second time, the brothers were at strife violently. But Christian was now too desperate to be scrupulous, for a dim glimpse had shot a possibility into his mind, and to be free to follow it, the striking of his brother was a necessity. Thank God he was armed, and so Swain's equal. Facing his assailant with the bear spear, he struck up his arms and with the butt end hit hard so that he fell. The matchless runner leapt away on the instant to follow a forlorn hope. Swain, on regaining his feet, was as amazed as angry at this unaccountable flight. He knew in his heart that his brother was no coward, and that it was unlike him to shrink from an encounter because defeat was certain and cruel humiliation from a vindictive victor probable. Of the uselessness of pursuit he was well aware. He must abide his chagrin, content to know that his time for advantage would come. Since Whitefell had parted to the right, Christian to the left, the event of a sequent encounter did not occur to him. And now Christian, acting on the dim glimpse he had had, just as Swain turned upon him, of something that moved against the sky along the ridge behind the homestead, was staking his only hope on a chance and his own superlative speed. If what he saw was really Whitefell, he guessed she was bending her steps towards the open wastes, and there was just a possibility that by a straight dash and a desperate, perilous leap over a sheer bluff, he might yet meet her or head her. And then he had no further thought. It was past, the quick, fierce race, and the chance of death at the leap, and he halted in a hollow to fetch his breath and to look. Did she come? Had she gone? She came. She came with a smooth, gliding, noiseless speed that was neither walking nor running. Her arms were folded in her furs that were drawn tight about her body. The white lappets from her head were wrapped and knotted closely beneath her face. Her eyes were set on a far distance. So she went, till the even sway of her going was startled to a pause by Christian. "Fell!" She drew a quick, sharp breath at the sound of her name, thus mutilated, and faced Swain's brother. Her eyes glittered, her upper lip was lifted and showed the teeth. The half of her name, impressed with an ominous sense as uttered by him, warned her of the aspect of a deadly foe. Yet she cast loose her robes till they trailed ample and spoke as a mild woman. "What would you?" Then Christian answered with his solemn, dreadful accusation. "You kissed Rawl, and Rawl is dead. You kissed Trella. She is dead. You have kissed Swain, my brother, but he shall not die." He added, "You may live till midnight." The edge of the teeth and the glitter of the eyes stayed a moment, and her right hand also slid down to the axe shaft. Then, without a word, she swerved from him and sprang out and away, swiftly, over the snow. And Christian sprang out and away and followed her swiftly over the snow, keeping behind but half a stride's length from her side. So they went running together, silent, towards the vast wastes of snow, where no living thing but they two moved under the stars of night. Never before had Christian so rejoiced in his powers. The gift of speed and the training of use and endurance were priceless to him now. Though midnight was hours away, he was confident that, go where that fell thing would, hasten as she would, she could not outstrip him nor escape from him. Then, when came the time for transformation, when the woman's form made no longer a shield against a man's hand, he could slay or be slain to save Swain. He had struck his dear brother in dire extremity, but he could not, though reason urged, strike a woman. For 1 mile, for 2 miles, they ran, Whitefell ever foremost, Christian ever at equal distance from her side, so near that now and again her outflying furs touched him. She spoke no word, nor he. She never turned her head to look at him, nor swerved to evade him, but with set face looking forward, sped straight on, over rough, over smooth, aware of his nearness by the regular beat of his feet and the sound of his breath behind. In a while she quickened her pace. From the first, Christian had judged of her speed as admirable, yet with exulting security in his own excelling and enduring whatever her efforts. But when the pace increased, he found himself put to the test as never had he been before in any race. Her feet indeed flew faster than his. It was only by his length of stride that he kept his place at her side. But his heart was high and resolute, and he did not fear failure yet. So the desperate race flew on. Their feet struck up the powdery snow, their breath smoked into the sharp, clear air, and they were gone before the air was cleared of snow and vapor. Now and then Christian glanced up to judge, by the rising of the stars, of the coming of midnight. So long, so long! Whitefell held on without slack. She, it was evident, with confidence in her speed proving matchless, as resolute to outrun her pursuer as he to endure till midnight and fulfill his purpose. And Christian held on, still self-assured. He could not fail. He would not fail. To avenge Rawl and Trella was motive enough for him to do what man could do. But for Swain, more. She had kissed Swain, but he should not die, too. With Swain to save, he could not fail. Never before was such a race as this. No, not when in old Greece man and maid raced together with two fates at stake. For the hard running was sustained and unabated, while star after star rose and went wheeling up towards midnight, for 1 hour, for 2 hours. Then Christian saw and heard what shot him through with fear. Where a fringe of trees hung round a slope, he saw something dark moving, and heard a yelp, followed by a full horrid cry, and the dark spread out upon the snow, a pack of wolves in pursuit. Of the beasts alone he had little cause for fear. At the pace he held he could distance them, four-footed though they were. But of Whitefell's wiles he had infinite apprehension, for how might she not avail herself of the savage jaws of these wolves, akin as they were to half her nature? She vouchsafed to them, nor look, nor sign, but Christian, on an impulse to assure himself that she should not escape him, caught and held the back-flung edge of her furs, running still. She turned like a flash with a beastly snarl, teeth and eyes gleaming again. Her axe shone on the upstroke, on the downstroke, as she hacked at his hand. She had lopped it off at the wrist, but that he parried with the bear spear. Even then she shore through the shaft and shattered the bones of the hand at the same blow, so that he loosed perforce. Then again they raced on as before, Christian not losing a pace, though his left hand swung useless, bleeding and broken. The snarl, indubitable, though modified from a woman's organs, the vicious fury revealed in teeth and eyes, the sharp, arrogant pain of her maiming blow, caught away Christian's heed of the beasts behind, by striking into him close, vivid realization of the infinitely greater danger that ran before him in that deadly thing. When he bethought him to look behind, lo, the pack had but reached their tracks and instantly slunk aside, cowed. The yell of pursuit changed to yelps and whines, so abhorrent was that fell creature to beast as to man. She had drawn her furs more closely to her, disposing them so that, instead of flying loose at her heels, no drapery hung lower than her knees, and this without a check to her wonderful speed, nor embarrassment by the cumbering of the folds. She held her head as before, her lips were firmly set, only the tense nostrils gave her breath, not a sign of distress witnessed to the long sustaining of that terrible speed. But on Christian by now the strain was telling palpably. His head weighed heavy, and his breath came laboring in great sobs. The bear spear would have been a burden now. His heart was beating like a hammer, but such a dullness oppressed his brain that it was only by degrees he could realize his helpless state. Wounded and weaponless, chasing that terrible thing that was a fierce, desperate, axe-armed woman, except she should assume the beast with fangs yet more formidable. And still the far, slow stars went lingering nearly an hour from midnight. So far was his brain astray that an impression took him that she was fleeing from the midnight stars, whose gain was by such slow degrees that a time equaling days and days had gone in the race round the northern circle of the world, and days as long might last before the end, except she slackened, or except he failed. But he would not fail yet. How long had he been praying so? He had started with a self-confidence and reliance that had felt no need for that aid, and now it seemed the only means by which to restrain his heart from swelling beyond the compass of his body, by which to cherish his brain from dwindling and shriveling quite away. Some sharp-toothed creature kept tearing and dragging at his maimed left hand. He never could see it. He could not shake it off, but he prayed it off at times. The clear stars before him took to shuddering, and he knew why. They shuddered at sight of what was behind him. He had never divined before that strange things hid themselves from men under pretense of being snow-clad mounds or swaying trees. But now they came slipping out from their harmless covers to follow him, and mock at his impotence to make a kindred thing resolve to truer form. He knew the air behind him was thronged. He heard the hum of innumerable murmurings together. But his eyes could never catch them. They were too swift and nimble. Yet he knew they were there, because on a backward glance he saw the snow mounds surge as they groveled flatlings out of sight. He saw the trees reel as they screwed themselves rigid past recognition among the boughs. And after such glance the stars for a while returned to steadfastness, and an infinite stretch of silence froze upon the chill gray world, only deranged by the swift even beat of the flying feet and his own, slower from the longer stride and the sound of his breath. And for some clear moments he knew that his only concern was to sustain his speed regardless of pain and distress, to deny with every nerve he had her power to outstrip him or widen the space between them, till the stars crept up to midnight. then out again would come that crowd invisible, humming and hustling behind, dense and dark enough, he knew, to blot out the stars at his back, yet ever skipping and jerking from his sight. A hideous check came to the race. Whitefell swirled about and leapt to the right, and Christian, unprepared for so prompt a lurch, found close at his feet a deep pit yawning, and his own impetus past control. But he snatched at her as he bore past, clasping her right arm with his one whole hand, and the two swung together upon the brink. And her straining away in self-preservation was vigorous enough to counterbalance his headlong impulse, and brought them reeling together to safety. Then, before he was verily sure that they were not to perish so, crashing down, he saw her gnashing in wild, pale fury as she wrenched to be free, and since her right hand was in his grasp, used her axe left-handed, striking back at him. The blow was effectual enough even so. His right arm dropped powerless, gashed, and with the lesser bone broken, that jarred with horrid pain when he let it swing, as he leaped out again and ran to recover the few feet she had gained from his paws at the shock. The near escape and this new quick pain made again every faculty alive and intense. He knew that what he followed was most surely death animate. Wounded and helpless, he was utterly at her mercy, if so she should realize and take action. Hopeless to avenge, hopeless to save, his very despair for Swain swept him on to follow, and follow, and precede the kiss doomed to death. Could he yet fail to hunt that thing past midnight out of the womanly form, alluring and treacherous, into lasting restraint of the bestial, which was the last shred of hope left from the confident purpose of the outset? Swain, Swain, oh, Swain! He thought he was praying, though his heart wrung out nothing but this, Swain, Swain, oh, Swain! The last hour from midnight had lost half its quarters, and the stars were lifting up the great minutes, and again his greatening heart and his shrinking brain and the sickening agony that swung at either side conspired to appall the will that had only seeming empire over his feet. Now Whitefell's body was so closely enveloped that not a lap nor an edge flew free. She stretched forward, strangely aslant, leaning from the upright poise of a runner. She cleared the ground at times by long bounds, gaining an increase of speed that Christian agonized to equal. Because the stars pointed that the end was nearing, the black brood came behind again and followed, noising. Ah, if they could but be kept quiet and still, nor slip their usual harmless masks to encourage with their interest the last speed of their most deadly congener. What shape had they? Should he ever know? If it were not that he was bound to compel the fell thing that ran before him into her truer form, he might face about and follow them. No, no, not so. If he might do anything but what he did, race, race, and racing bear this agony, he would just stand still and die to be quit of the pain of breathing. He grew bewildered, uncertain of his own identity, doubting of his own true form. He could not be really a man, no more than that running thing was really a woman. His real form was only hidden under embodiment of a man, but what it was he did not know. And Swain's real form he did not know. Swain lay fallen at his feet where he had struck him down, his own brother. He stumbled over him and had to overleap him and race harder because she who had kissed Swain leapt so fast. Swain, Swain, oh, Swain! Why did the stars stop to shudder? Midnight else had surely come. The leaning, leaping thing looked back at him with a wild, fierce look and laughed in savage scorn and triumph. He saw in a flash why, for within a time measurable by seconds, she would have escaped him utterly. As the land lay, a slope of ice slunk on the one hand. On the other, a steep rose, shouldering forwards. Between the two was space for a foot to be planted, but none for a body to stand. Yet a juniper bough, thrusting out, gave a handhold secure enough for one with a resolute grasp to swing past the perilous place and pass on safe. Though the first seconds of the last moment were going, she dared to flash back a wicked look and laugh at the pursuer who was impotent to grasp. The crisis struck convulsive life into his last supreme effort. His will surged up indomitable. His speed proved matchless yet. He leapt with a rush, passed her before her laugh had time to go out, and turned short, barring the way, and braced to withstand her. She came hurling desperate, with a feint to the right hand, and then launched herself upon him with a spring like a wild beast when it leaps to kill. And he, with one strong arm and a hand that could not hold, with one strong hand and an arm that could not guide and sustain, he caught and held her even so, and they fell together. And because he felt his whole arm slipping and his whole hand loosing to slack the dreadful agony of the wrenched bone above, he caught and held with his teeth the tunic at her knee as she struggled up and wrung off his hands to overleap him victorious. Like lightning she snatched her axe and struck him on the neck, deep, once, twice. His life-blood gushed out, staining her feet. The stars touched midnight. The death scream he heard was not his, for his set teeth had hardly yet relaxed when it rang out. And the dreadful cry began with a woman's shriek and changed and ended as the yell of a beast. And before the final blank overtook his dying eyes, he saw that she gave place to it. He saw more, that life gave place to death, causelessly, incomprehensibly. For he did not presume that no holy water could be more holy, more potent to destroy an evil thing than life-blood of a pure heart poured out for another in free-willing devotion. His own true hidden reality that he had desired to know grew palpable, recognizable. It seemed to him just this, a great, glad, abounding hope that he had saved his brother. Too expansive to be contained by the limited form of a soul man, it yearned for a new embodiment, infinite as the stars. What did it matter to that true reality that the man's brain shrank, shrank, till it was nothing, that the man's body could not retain the huge pain of his heart, and heaved it out through the red exit riven at the neck? That the black noise came again, hurtling from behind, reinforced by that dissolved shape, and blotted out forever the man's sight, hearing, sense. In the early gray of day, Swain chanced upon the footprints of a man, of a runner, as he saw by the shifted snow, and the direction they had taken aroused curiosity, since a little farther their line must be crossed by the edge of a sheer height. He turned to trace them, and, so doing, the length of the stride struck his attention, a stride long as his own, if he ran. He knew he was following Christian. In his anger he had hardened himself to be indifferent to the night-long absence of his brother. But now, seeing where the footsteps went, he was seized with compunction and dread. He had failed to give thought and care to his poor, frantic twin, who might, was it possible, have rushed to a frantic death. His heart stood still when he came to the place where the leap had been taken. A piled edge of snow had fallen, too, and nothing but snow lay below when he peered. Along the upper edge he ran for a furlong, till he came to a dip where he could slip and climb down, and then back again on the lower level to the pile of fallen snow. There he saw that the vigorous running had started afresh. He stood pondering, vexed that any man should have taken that leap where he had not ventured to follow, vexed that he had been beguiled to such painful emotions, guessing vainly at Christian's object in this mad freak. He began sauntering along, half unconsciously following his brother's track, and so in a while he came to the place where the footprints were doubled. Small prints were these others, small as a woman's, though the pace from one to another was longer than that which the skirts of women allow. Did not Whitefell tread so? A dreadful guess appalled him, so dreadful that he recoiled from belief. Yet his face grew ashy white, and he gasped to fetch back motion to his checked heart. Unbelievable? Close attention showed how the smaller footfall had altered for greater speed, striking into the snow with a deeper onset and a lighter pressure on the heels. Unbelievable? Could any woman but Whitefell run so? Could any man but Christian run so? The guess became a certainty. He was following where alone in the dark night Whitefell had fled from Christian pursuing. Such villainy set heart and brain on fire with rage and indignation. Such villainy in his own brother, till lately loveworthy, praiseworthy, though a fool for meekness. He would kill Christian. Had he lives many as the footprints he had trodden, vengeance should demand them all. In a tempest of murderous hate, he followed on in haste, for the track was plain enough, starting with such a burst of speed as could not be maintained, but brought him back soon to applaud for the spent, sobbing breath to be regulated. He cursed Christian aloud and called Whitefell's name on high in a frenzied expense of passion. His grief itself was a rage, being such an intolerable anguish of pity and shame at the thought of his love. Whitefell, who had parted from his kiss, free and radiant, to be hounded straightway by his brother, mad with jealousy, fleeing for more than life while her lover was housed at his ease. If he had but known, he raved, in impotent rebellion at the cruelty of events, if he had but known that his strength and love might have availed in her defense. Now the only service to her that he could render was to kill Christian. As a woman, he knew she was matchless in speed, matchless in strength. But Christian was matchless in speed among men, nor easily to be matched in strength. Brave and swift and strong though she were, what chance had she against a man of his strength and inches, frantic, too, and intent on horrid revenge against his brother, his successful rival? Mile after mile he followed with a bursting heart. More piteous, more tragic, seemed the case at this evidence of Whitefell's splendid supremacy, holding her own so long against Christian's famous speed, so long that his love and admiration grew more and more boundless, and his grief and indignation therewith also. Whenever the track lay clear, he ran with such reckless prodigality of strength that it soon was spent, and he dragged on heavily, till sometimes on the ice of a mere, sometimes on a wind-swept place, all signs were lost, but so undeviating had been their line that a course straight on and then short questing to either hand recovered them again. Hour after hour had gone by through more than half that winter day before ever he came to the place where the trampled snow showed that a scurry of feet had come and gone, wolves' feet, and gone most amazingly. Only a little beyond he came to the lopped point of Christian's bear spear. Farther on he would see where the remnant of the useless shaft had been dropped. The snow here was dashed with blood, and the footsteps of the two had fallen closer together. some hoarse sound of exultation came from him that might have been a laugh had breath sufficed. "Oh, Whitefell, my poor, brave love, well struck!" he groaned, torn by his pity and great admiration, as he guessed surely how she had turned and dealt a blow. The sight of the blood inflamed him as it might a beast that ravens. He grew mad with a desire to have Christian by the throat once again, not to loose this time till he had crushed out his life, or beat out his life, or stabbed out his life, or all these, and torn him piecemeal likewise, and ah, then, not till then, bleed his heart with weeping, like a child, like a girl, over the piteous fate of his poor lost love. On, 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 through the aching time, toiling and straining in the track of those two superb runners, aware of the marvel of their endurance, but unaware of the marvel of their speed, that in the 3 hours before midnight had overpassed all that vast distance that he could only traverse from twilight to twilight. For clear daylight was passing when he came to the edge of an old marl pit and saw how the two who had gone before had stamped and trampled together in desperate peril on the verge. And here fresh bloodstains spoke to him of a valiant defense against his infamous brother. And he followed where the blood had dripped till the cold had stanched its flow, taking a savage gratification from this evidence that Christian had been gashed deeply, maddening afresh with desire to do likewise more excellently, and so slake his murderous hate. And he began to know that through all his despair he had entertained a germ of hope that grew apace, rained upon by his brother's blood. He strove on as best he might, wrung now by an access of hope, now of despair, in agony to reach the end, however terrible, sick with the aching of the toiled miles that deferred it. And the light went lingering out of the sky, giving place to uncertain stars. He came to the finish. Two bodies lay in a narrow place. Christian's was one, but the other beyond, not Whitefell's. There, where the footsteps ended, lay a great white wolf. At the sight, Swain's strength was blasted. Body and soul he was struck down, groveling. The stars had grown sure and intense before he stirred from where he had dropped prone. Very feebly he crawled to his dead brother and laid his hands upon him and crouched so, afraid to look or stir farther. Cold, stiff hours, dead. Yet the dead body was his only shelter and stay in that most dreadful hour. His soul, stripped bare of all skeptic comfort, cowered, shivering, naked, abject, and the living clung to the dead out of piteous need for grace from the soul that had passed away. He rose to his knees, lifting the body. Christian had fallen face forward in the snow, with his arms flung up and wide, and so had the frost made him rigid, strange, ghastly, unyielding to Swain's lifting, so that he laid him down again and crouched above, with his arms fast round him, and a low, heart-wrung groan. When at last he found force to raise his brother's body and gather it in his arms, tight clasped to his breast, he tried to face the thing that lay beyond. The sight set his limbs in a palsy with horror and dread. His senses had failed and fainted in utter cowardice, but for the strength that came from holding dead Christian in his arms, enabling him to compel his eyes to endure the sight and take into the brain the complete aspect of the thing. No wound, only bloodstains on the feet. The great grim jaws had a savage grin, though dead stiff. And his kiss, he could bear it no longer, and turned away, nor ever looked again. And the dead man in his arms, knowing the full horror, had followed and faced it for his sake, had suffered agony and death for his sake. In the neck was the deep death gash. One arm and both hands were dark with frozen blood, for his sake. Dead he knew him, as in life he had not known him, to give the right meed of love and worship. Because the outward man lacked perfection and strength equal to his, he had taken the love and worship of that great pure heart as his due. He, so unworthy in the inner reality, so mean, so despicable, callous and contemptuous towards the brother who had laid down his life to save him. He longed for utter annihilation, that so he might lose the agony of knowing himself so unworthy such perfect love. The frozen calm of death on the face appalled him. He dared not touch it with lips that had cursed so lately, with lips fouled by kiss of the horror that had been death. He struggled to his feet, still clasping Christian. The dead man stood upright within his arm, frozen rigid. The eyes were not quite closed. The head had stiffened, bowed slightly to one side. The arms stayed straight and wide. It was the figure of one crucified, the blood-stained hands also conforming. So living and dead went back along the track that one had passed in the deepest passion of love and one in the deepest passion of hate. All that night Swain toiled through the snow, bearing the weight of dead Christian, treading back along the steps he before had trodden, when he was wronging with vilest thoughts and cursing with murderous hatred the brother who all the while lay dead for his sake. Cold, silence, darkness encompassed the strong man, bowed with a dolorous burden. And yet he knew surely that that night he entered hell, and trod hellfire along the homeward road, and endured through it only because Christian was with him. And he knew surely that to him Christian had been as Christ, and had suffered and died to save him from his sins.